Our basic premise this week has been to kind of isolate the Gospel of Luke and to look at what's going on between the two kingdoms that are represented. And we're not going to go into a lot from yesterday, but just a quick reminder, when we talk about the kingdom of God in the Gospel of Luke, we're not talking about it in the broad sense of everything's under the control of God, but rather the idea of Christ coming in and the salvation that he offers versus the kingdom of Satan, which, as we said yesterday, is not the same as the kingdom of God, because at best, Satan's kind of a renegade ruler. His followers deny God, even though God is their God. And so what Luke is doing is he's showing us this conflict that's going on as Jesus comes in to kind of knock the doors open of this kingdom of darkness to allow escape. And so throughout the Gospel of Luke, we're going to see what I believe are some very stark differences, where Luke is, through, of course, the inspiration of the Spirit, is giving us these different ways of viewing what's going on the side of wickedness and how Christ is confronting that and ultimately overcoming it. So this morning, we're going to take this in a kind of an interesting direction, I think, and that's the conflict between Jesus and the religious elite. So why is this different? Well, it's different in the sense of the religious elite thought they were on the good side. It wasn't as though they were saying, we want to do the work of Satan, we're against what's good, we're against what's godly. No. In fact, it was just the opposite. They viewed Jesus as being on the side of evil and themselves being on the side of good. And I think this is both an important and a little bit of a frightening study, actually, because it shows us how easily we can get off track on something, and yet in being off track, view ourselves as certainly being on track and being kind of the ones who are the authority, the ones who are holding righteousness, when at the entire time, we're kind of working against what's right. So again, very important lesson, but also a very practical lesson for us. Now, when we talk about the religious elite, typically the name that's going to come to mind more often than not is going to be the name Pharisee. We still hear that used a lot, don't we, in 2019. If someone thinks you're a little too strict on something, they might just haul off and call you a Pharisee. That's not a compliment. It's the idea of you are serious about your religion. Let me tell you, I'll take that compliment any day of the week, won't you? If somebody says to me, you're trying to stick close to the Scripture, you're trying to do exactly what's right, that's not really who the Pharisees were in the first century. They were people who thought that's what they were doing. But yet they had developed a religion all their own in a lot of ways. They had viewed themselves as the authority and had put themselves on an equal plane with God in their teaching. And so as we consider the Pharisees, I want to talk just a little bit about them as we look at this conflict that's going on, this good versus evil. I came across a pretty good quote that's going to show just how important this group is in the first century. I don't know that we always get it of just who we're talking about, just how powerful they were. Let's look at this quote together. This is a man who did a fair amount of research on the Pharisees. And he said this: they had the bulk of the nation as their ally, and women especially were in their hands. They had the greatest influence upon the congregations, so that all acts of public worship, prayers, and sacrifices were performed according to their injunctions. Their sway over the masses was so absolute that they could obtain a hearing even when they said anything against the king or the high priest. Consequently, they were the most capable of counteracting the design of the kings. Hence, too, the Sadducees and their official acts adhered to the demands of the Pharisees, because otherwise the multitude would not have tolerated them. Wow, let that sink in for a minute. Here's kind of a king maker here, isn't it? The Pharisees wielded such influence that even their enemies, the Sadducees, had to go along with them on most occasions. That's who we're talking about. And so when Jesus comes to the earth, what he's going to find really as his greatest nemesis, in a human form anyway, will be this group. Okay? They're going to be the ones who are against him. And so what I want us to do this morning is to look at both sides, to look and see how the Pharisees, along with their allies, are viewing Jesus. And then we're going to turn it around and see how Jesus is viewing the Pharisees. And then we'll make some applications from there. All right, so we know, overall, they hated him. All right? No love lost between the Pharisees and Jesus. And so, as we begin to trace this in the Gospel of Luke, Luke is going to start out and he's going to show us that at the very beginning, they're viewing Jesus as kind of a curiosity. And so I won't go over a lot of this because we talked about it to an extent yesterday, but just a quick reminder. What are the two things Jesus is doing in his ministry? He's preaching the good news of the kingdom and he's healing. And that's what he's telling his disciples and his apostles to do, to imitate that example. And so at first, we've got the Pharisees, we're told, coming from all directions because here is this curiosity. Now, why is he a curiosity? Well, he's not one of them, right? He's not of their group. He's not sanctioned by the Pharisees. And so as they began to hear about this guy up in the northern part of the country and he's preaching and he's teaching and he's healing, they began to really question what's going on. But that curiosity doesn't last too long before we find that turning into a full-blown hatred. By chapter 5 in the book, we've got the Pharisees who are no longer just saying, well, this is kind of odd, you know, this is kind of a weird guy who's coming along. They're viewing him as a flat-out blasphemer. Now, if you'll remember here in chapter 5, and we're not going to turn to all of these passages, but you might just want to kind of flip along in your Bible as we go through, look down and reference what we're talking about. In verse 17, this is the account of where they bring the paralytic to Jesus. And you'll recall they have to push the roof tiles away and lower the guy down. You remember the first thing Jesus says to him? He says, your sins are forgiven. Okay, that was on purpose. Jesus was making a major statement to this religious elite. I'm more than just some backcountry teacher. I'm more than just somebody who's bringing this message. I have the power of God, who alone can forgive sins but God. And so Jesus says that. And so he knows at this point that the Pharisees are questioning what's going on. Even if they're not saying anything, they're questioning what's going on. And he says, okay, so that you'll know that I've got the power to forgive sins, I'll heal the guy for you. Take up your bed and walk. And the guy gets up immediately and he walks away. And so this is going to see a fairly major shift in how the Pharisees are viewing Jesus. They're going to view him now as one who is guilty of blasphemy. That's going to go so far that you'll remember over in chapter 11, we find when Jesus is casting out a demon, the Pharisees are going to say, well, the only way he could do this is by the power of Beelzebul or the devil. The only way he could do this, if he's working on the side of Satan, and of course that's when Jesus gives his speech and he says, can a house be divided against itself? If Satan's working against Satan, isn't his house going to collapse? But I want you to note, as Luke is progressing, before we get much closer than halfway through, he's already showing us that the Pharisees and their allies are now viewing Jesus as somebody from Satan himself. Okay, we're getting a picture here of what's going on. Curiosity has turned into this view that he blasphemes, which goes to the extent that he's from Satan himself. All right, so that's what we're looking at as we see all of this taking place. The reason that they are so upset about Jesus is they think that he's violating the law of Moses. And that's because they had gotten such a stilted view of the law that when Jesus comes and he lives the law perfectly, to them it looks like he's guilty of violating it. And so we find, again, kind of flipping back to a little bit earlier in the book, to chapter 6, verses 1 and 2, we find Jesus talking about himself being Lord of the Sabbath. And much of what we're going to find in these conflicts is going to center around the Sabbath. Now, one thing to notice as you study the book of Luke, I think it's five times, we have Jesus healing on the Sabbath day. Well, was that just a coincidence? Was it just kind of out of the blue? Well, absolutely not. What Jesus is doing is he's meeting the religious elite face to face. He's not running from them. And so what we're going to find on occasions will be Jesus saying, I am going to show you full out exactly who I am, what's right and what's wrong. Now, we might note here in chapter 6, if we go down to verse 6, it says, on another Sabbath he entered the synagogue and he was teaching, and a man was there whose right hand was withered. Now, pay particular attention to verse 7. It says, the scribes and the Pharisees watched him to see whether he would heal on the Sabbath so that they might find a reason to accuse him. All right, so you see what's going on? They're lying in wait. And I, you know, this is speculation, but I just kind of believe they've probably put this man with a withered hand in place. You know, he's kind of the one who's put there, and they're watching Jesus to see if he's going to heal this man or not. And of course, Jesus knows that, but he doesn't run from that. So time after time after time, he's showing, I'm the Lord of the Sabbath. I set the rules in place for the Sabbath. I know what you can do and what you can't do on it. Yet the Pharisees are viewing him as a lawbreaker because of that. All right, so we've got a lot of that healing going on. That's getting their attention, of course. Now, this is a big one. This is a really big one. We'll see this coming out a little bit later in our lesson this morning. One of the things that caused the Pharisees to discount Jesus so much was the company that he kept. You remember when Jesus comes in, he's with tax collectors and sinners and publicans and prostitutes and all of these ones who are viewed as being inferior. These are people who really aren't worth the time and attention that a Pharisee has. So when the Pharisees see him many, many times in his ministry, kind of going to this outcast group, these people who are on the fringes, they don't like it at all. And so chapter 7, you might flip over just for a minute here, chapter 7, as we look on down to verse 39, what we're finding here is this woman who comes in, and the Pharisees again are watching. They're at this feast, and you notice verse 39, now, when the Pharisee who had invited him, Jesus, saw that he was having a conversation with this woman, letting her wash his feet, he said to himself, if this man were a prophet, he would have known who and what sort of woman this is who is touching him, for she is a sinner. All right, now he's just thinking it. Jesus takes him on. He says, she's doing for me what you didn't do. She's showing me the basis of hospitality here that you failed in. And so what we're going to find is that Jesus is looking with mercy and sympathy to this group of people who have been all but forgotten by the religious elite. And he's saying the Lord loves these people. The Lord is interested in their salvation. But the Pharisees didn't like that at all. And so throughout the book, we're going to find them really coming down on Jesus because of the companions that he kept. And then ultimately, when we get to the end of the book, what they're going to try to do is to have him destroyed. It's kind of almost comical if it weren't so serious. Every time the Pharisees try to confront Jesus, they get decimated, don't they? They'll try to meet him in argument, Jesus puts them in their place. They try to accuse him, Jesus comes with a true understanding of the law. So finally, by the end of the book, they understand they're not going to beat him intellectually. They're not going to beat him spiritually. So they decide, we've just got to have him killed. We've got to get rid of him. And so what we find in this then is the Pharisees really trying their best, and they think, working alongside Judas and Pilate, that they've done him in. And so I'm sure there was somewhat of a streak of fear when they find out he's been raised from the dead. He's not going to be defeated by them. But this is their view of them. All right, so they're viewing him first as a curiosity and then as a blasphemer and one who is from Satan. And they don't like his teaching and they don't like him working on the Sabbath. They don't like him meeting with these people. And so ultimately, they want him destroyed. Now, let's kind of change to the other side. When we look at what Luke is telling us is Jesus' view of the religious elite, we're going to get a much clearer picture of who they are. Now again, put yourself in the first century. If we were common Jews, we would have a pretty healthy respect for the Pharisees. Fear, we'd be scared of them, because if they caught us doing something, they could have us kicked out of the synagogue. They exercised that amount of power. But also kind of a respect for the amount of knowledge they had. If you wanted an answer for the law, that's who you would go to. But Jesus sees them for who they really are. And so throughout the gospel, Luke is going to record for us these pictures that Jesus is giving us of the Pharisees. Now chapter 6, verse 37, we have a familiar reading there about judge not that you be not judged. For with the judgment you measure out, by that judgment you will be judged. Well, who was that aimed at? Well, it's good information for all of us, but who was it aimed at? Square at the Pharisees. Jesus was saying, what you are doing is judging in such a way and by a standard that you are unwilling to accept for yourself. And he says, now, if you're treating people that way, you need to understand that God is going to use that same kind of judgment on you. If you show no mercy, if you show no love, okay, we'll expect that kind of judgment from God. That's what you're going to receive also. All right, so when we look at the Pharisees, here were people who were very, very good at hyper-judgment on others. But they could not accept the fact that at times they needed to be rebuked. And so what Jesus is saying to them here is, you got it all messed up. You are false judges. He says that they wouldn't go and listen to John. All right, they're ignoring the message of God. Here John comes preaching the coming kingdom, but yet they wouldn't listen to him, that they wouldn't obey him. They didn't believe that that was the message of God. I want us to pause here for just a minute in chapter 11. Go ahead and turn over there with me if you will. Aren't you always a little bit amused when you hear Christians say, I just don't like that hellfire and brimstone preaching? Well, you know Jesus is the biggest hellfire and brimstone preacher who's ever walked the earth. All right? The message he gives is saying, you got to make a decision. And this is one of those passages where you can almost feel the smoke, smell the smoke rising off of it here. Because here is a section where he's going to take on the Pharisees and he's going to kind of pull an Old Testament word forward, and that's the word woe. Whenever you hear in the Bible or read in the Bible, woe unto you because, all right, here's something big. And so Jesus here is pronouncing all of these woes on them because they're continuing to miss the entire point of what salvation is all about. So let's skip down to verse 42. And he says, woe to you Pharisees, for you tithe mint and rue and every herb and neglect justice and the love of God. These you ought to have done without neglecting the others. Woe to you Pharisees, for you love the best seat in the synagogue and greetings in the marketplace. Woe to you, for you are like unmarked graves and people walk over them without knowing it. Now listen to what he's saying. He's saying, you get all the little stuff right, and that's good. Problem is, you miss the big stuff. You know, you've learned to measure out a tenth of everything, but you have no idea what love and mercy and justice are all about. And he says, the problem with you is when you go to the synagogue, it's not for God, it's for you. You're wanting the best seat. You're wanting to be recognized as the authority. And he says, what I want to compare you to is like a grave. looks awfully nice on the outside, all painted up, whitewashed, looking good, but we know what's on the inside. It's full of filth, it's full of dead men's bones. Now, I do think this is a little bit of a funny passage here, because as he's going through all of this, verse 45, the lawyers, or sometimes that'll be translated scribes, it says, one of the lawyers answered him, "Teacher, in saying these things, you insult us also." So what does Jesus do? Apologize? "Woe to you, lawyers." So, you know, it's kind of like he's saying, "You got it. I am putting you all in the same boat. You are all doing the same thing. This hypocrisy, this lawlessness that you're practicing." And so he gets on to them and he says, "You know, you decorate the tombs of the prophets, but your fathers killed them and you're just finishing off the job. They all prophesied about me, and now what you're trying to do is kill me. You're just wanting to finish their work." Tell you what, you can feel the heat rising off this passage, can't you? And that's exactly what we need to feel, because here Jesus is saying to the Pharisees, to the scribes, "You are missing it. You are hypocrites. You've missed everything that this is about." And so we find that word being used, the idea of a false face or appearing to be something that you're not. Important to note that he calls them lovers of money, because that's a pretty major theme in the Gospel of Luke also, this relationship of the godly and ungodly to wealth. And he's going to tell us in chapter 16, verse 14, the Pharisees, who were lovers of money. All right, so we know where their priorities were. Two parables we're going to find where he illustrates, actually three. I'm going to talk more extensively about one of them here in a minute, but a couple just in passing, where Jesus is giving us a picture of what the Pharisees are like. First one, I tell you what, you don't have to have any imagination to figure out what he's saying in this one, Pharisee and the tax collector. You'll recall, here's one of the people on the fringes, tax collector. Pharisees hated them, viewed them as outcasts. So in this parable, Jesus pictures a Pharisee and a tax collector going up to pray. And what does the Pharisee do? You ever notice all of the I's in that? "Lord, I do this, and I do that." It's all about him. And in contrast, here's a tax collector. It says he couldn't even lift his face, but simply said, "God, be merciful to me, a sinner." And then we have the rhetorical question. Who went to his house justified? Well, the Pharisees just wouldn't get it. They wouldn't understand that they were missing everything about godliness because they allowed themselves to get in the way. They were the whitewashed tomb. They were the one who needed the best seat. And what Jesus is saying is, God so much more respects the humility of this man than this Pharisee who believes himself to be so righteous. Now another, maybe not quite as obvious to us, I think it would have been to them, and that's in the parable of the wicked tenants over in chapter 20. You'll recall in this parable, you've got a man who's planted this vineyard and he's let it out to the tenants. In other words, he's rented it out to them. And when it comes time to get part of the fruit of that vineyard, the owner sends his servants back and they beat up the servants and kill them. And he says, "I'm going to send my own son," and they kill him also. Well, who are the wicked tenants in that parable? Those are the Pharisees. That's the religious elite. And what Jesus is saying is, here's God who's given you this responsibility. He's allowed you to have great influence amongst his people, but yet you kill the prophets who I sent to. You wouldn't listen to them, even bringing about their destruction. And even with my son, you rejected him. So, throughout his teaching, I want you to know, Jesus never backs down. He does not back down, which is important because a lot of times we sometimes are tempted to be very conciliatory. We're looking for points of agreement, and we may say, well, we might disagree on this, but, well, there are times for that, very much times for that, but never at the compromise of the truth. Never at the compromise of what's right. And so when Jesus looks at the Pharisees, sadly, what he's looking at is somebody in the kingdom of wickedness, someone on the side of the devil, though they appear to be righteous and on God's side. He's saying you are working against God with everything you've got. Now, I want us to kind of slow things down for just a few minutes here, because there's a parable that I believe just gives us the clearest picture of everything going on here. And it's one of the best known parables of Jesus. People who don't even know much about the Bible, a lot of times, will have this concept of the Good Samaritan. We even have laws by that name, don't we? Good Samaritan laws to protect people who are trying to help somebody who's in need. Well, this is really a picture of the two kingdoms at work. It's a picture of what's going on here. And so let's just take a few minutes and look at this. This is back in chapter 10. And let's note the lead up to it, beginning in verse 25. Chapter 10, verse 25. It says, "And behold, a lawyer stood up to put him to the test, saying, 'Teacher, what shall I do to inherit eternal life?' And he said to him, 'What is written in the law? How do you read it?' And he answered, 'You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your strength and with all your mind, and your neighbor as yourself.' And he said to him, 'You have answered correctly. Do this and you will live.'" Okay. The testing here is not just simply trying to find an answer. The definition of that word is to put someone to the test beyond reasonable limits. Okay, so what he's trying to do is trap Jesus. And so Jesus, as he oftentimes will do, turns it around and he says, "Well, what do you think about it?" The man gets it right. He gets the answer exactly right. And he's very on the ball, because he also puts the second greatest command. You love God with everything you've got. You love your neighbor as yourself. Jesus says, "You have answered correctly." And if he would have just walked away, we would have been done here. But this guy had a problem many of us have. When we feel like we have been bested, we don't accept the fact that maybe we need to think about the answer we've received, but we keep on talking. What does this man do? Well, look at what Luke tells us, verse 29. "But desiring to justify himself, he said to Jesus, 'Who is my neighbor?'" The man has set himself up for the kill here. You see what's going on? He's put himself up against Jesus. He's not learned what's going to happen. And so what Jesus is going to do is to present a story that will force the man to see who his neighbor is. And of course, we know it as the parable of the Good Samaritan. So what's going on? Well, the guy's on the Jericho Road, and he's robbed, and he's beaten, and he's left for dead. So We got to put our people into place here. Understanding a parable is understanding what Jesus is trying to accomplish through the participants, the characters. Well, this man are those outcasts. They're the neglected of society. Tax collectors, prostitutes, poor, sick. These people who the Pharisees have completely turned their attention against them. Here they are. And so Jesus pictures them as this man who's laying there and he's about to die. These people on the fringes, who the Pharisees, the religious elite, would have said, they are not worthy of our attention. They are not worthy of anything that we have to offer. So, what's going to happen next? Well, Jesus is going to introduce us to a couple of more folks in this. And what he pictures is a priest and a Levite, also on this road. Now, you've noticed this. What do they do? Well, they're holy in appearance. In other words, when you saw them, you knew who they were by what they were wearing, by how they conducted themselves with their regalia and such. But what do they do in this parable? Well, as Jesus tells the story, he has them going to the other side of the road to avoid contact with the man. Okay, that's really important, because what Jesus has been trying to get across to the Pharisees concerning these outcasts, They're the ones who need you. Somebody who's sick has no need of a physician. Here are the people who have been left behind by society. Here are the people who need God. And so in the parable, Jesus is purposely having the two religious people who should have had the love and the mercy for this guy to help him. They're saying, we don't even want to get close because he could make us unholy. He could make us unclean. You know, we could take this beyond what Jesus perhaps intended and picture these two men. Maybe they're heading to Jerusalem. They're going to offer a sacrifice. They're going to do something in regards to their religious work. And they look at this guy and they say, well, if I go over and help him and he's dead, I'm unclean. I can't do my work. And so rather than showing mercy, the idea of, we're not going to get our hands dirty with this. That is the Pharisee. That is the religious elite in how they're viewing these people in society. So who do we have next? Well, we've got the one for whom the parable is named. And I don't know if you're like me. A lot of times when I've studied this parable, it's kind of the application of, well, we need to be a good Samaritan. And I think that is a very good application, by the way. But that's not the biggie. Who is the good Samaritan? The good Samaritan is Jesus Christ. All right? He is the one who's represented by this guy, which is so interesting. That in the parable, Jesus would take a Samaritan who was utterly hated by the religious elite and make him the good guy. You see how Jesus is confronting them on a host of levels here? He's saying, okay, you know, you've crossed to the other side of the road, but the good guy in this parable is somebody who you hate, who you consider a dog, who you consider unworthy. He's going to be the one who does what you should have done. Jesus is the Good Samaritan. How do we know that? Well, it's by his actions. Here's the one who is compassionate. What does Luke tell us about Jesus? Jesus filled with compassion. Why did he heal all these people? Why did he cast out demons? He felt sorry for them. He knew this wasn't the way it was supposed to be. And so because of his compassion, why did he teach people? Why did he look at them as sheep with no shepherd? Well, we've got it. And that's pictured here within this parable. Secondly, what are we going to find? Here is this Samaritan and he's providing the healing. He's taking care of the man. What did Jesus do? Well, he literally healed, didn't he? We have a point being made of that over and over again, that Jesus was a healer, that he was the great physician who had come. What else do we find? Well, we find that he paid the debt. Remember that? He takes the guy to the inn, and he says to the innkeeper, here's the money for him. If he still needs to stay and he runs up a tab, I'll be back, I'll pay the debt. What does Paul tell us in Romans 5 about Jesus? He paid the debt for us. What does he also do? He provides a place to stay. What does John tell us? Well, he records the words of Jesus, I go to my Father's house to prepare a place for you. You see how this Samaritan is the one who's giving us a picture of Jesus Christ? He's doing all of these things, whereas the religious were rejecting those who were different, those who needed their help. Jesus was going full throttle to help anybody who was in need. So when we look at this parable, it presents us a clear view of the distinction between good and evil. Here's evil guising itself as righteous, but not doing the work of the righteous. Here is Jesus Christ showing us what goodness is all about. So we take all of that, we put it with these other teachings and parables, and I think we find what the religious elite were like versus Jesus, the evil versus the good. Now, let me make just a couple of more points here, and then we're going to kind of bring it to some applications for us. Sadly, the Pharisees never get it. They never get it. They reject Jesus, and to the very end, we see this distinction between the evil that they had versus the good of Jesus. At the end of his life, they're seeking to bring him down. As we noted yesterday, they're going to accomplish that through Judas. Can you imagine the delight of the religious elite when one of Jesus' own comes and says, I want to sell him out? Because that gave them two really good opportunities. First, they could get Jesus, which they've been unable to do. Second thing is they could pin the blame on one of his inner circle. Well, one of his own did this to him. One of his own sold him out. So they're going to work through Judas. They're going to work through Pilate. Pilate shows himself to be very weak. He knows Jesus is innocent. We'll look at that, Lord willing, a little bit toward the end of our study on Thursday or Friday. We'll see Pilate in that light. But yet Pilate is unwilling to go against the Pharisees, against the religious elite, because he knows they can bring him down. They can cause him trouble. And the one thing you don't want if you're a Roman governor is trouble, because you get hauled to Rome and you may get thrown in jail or worse. So they get what they think they want. But look at the contrast. What do we find between these two? Well, as Jesus hangs on the cross, they scoff at him. If you're the Son of God, pull yourself down off the cross. Save yourself. They're showing their evil to the very end. They're showing whose kingdom they're in to the very end. But what about Jesus? Jesus prays for them. Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. These people who had caused him so much trouble through the years of his ministry, ultimately orchestrating the terms around his death, Jesus prays that they can be forgiven. Now, what does that show us? That shows us what true righteousness is all about. That shows us what it means to be godly. And I imagine most of us would probably have to admit that when we get in situations far less severe than this, but yet where somebody's kind of coming against us, we have a hard time looking out for their well-being. But yet that's exactly what Jesus does. So here's the picture. Now, as we kind of bring all of this to a conclusion today, I want us to understand that kind of where we started with all of this, that the Pharisees are a scary group because they show us what we so easily can become. If I'm called a Pharisee because I'm strict, that's not a problem. If I'm called a Pharisee for the same problems they had, that is trouble. And so let's talk about a couple of ways that that can happen. Hey, one of the big things that we find about the Pharisees is that they made themselves the standard. Mark's going to tell us the words of Jesus where he says they teach as doctrine. They teach us commandment, the traditions of men. Just very briefly here, one of the problems the Pharisees had is that they started off really, really good. They said, we don't want to break any commands, and so we're going to come up with ways not to even get close to breaking those commands. That was their traditions. That was just fine. The problem was after a few years, they started teaching that the traditions were as binding as the law of God itself. You see what happened? They equated their tradition on an equal par with God Himself. And so that's the real problem here. But they didn't see it that way. They didn't see themselves as adding to the law. They didn't see themselves as people who were trying to get in the same place as God. Well, can that happen to us? Are there times maybe when we begin to look at things and we begin kind of like they did to put themselves in the place of God, we do the same? You see, good traditions are not the same as good law. There may be things that I do to keep myself from sinning, I think all of us do that, right? We all come up with ways to try to keep ourselves from sinning. But the minute I start teaching those kinds of things on parity with the law of God, I'm in a lot of trouble. I'm doing the exact same things the Pharisees do. And we could go through a whole host of those that we see even amongst ourselves that we oftentimes do. But the warning in this lesson on good and evil, Jesus versus the religious elite, is that we cannot allow ourselves to do that kind of thing. We can't allow ourselves to have that same kind of temptation to put our beliefs on the par with God. So hard to see, though, isn't it? Well, let me give you one other. This is one that's kind of been on my mind a lot lately, and that is this hostility that the Pharisees showed toward the outcast of society. I have tried to picture myself in the first century, and sometimes I don't like that picture very much, because we tend to think that people who are in these kinds of situations will say, well, they did it to themselves. And that's true. To a large extent, that's true. But did Jesus not also know that? You know, this woman who has sold herself into prostitution, didn't Jesus know she got herself in that situation? He did. Or, you know, here's this person who, you know, maybe takes a position that's not the best socially. Well, he got himself in that situation. Well, that's true. He did. But what did Jesus want to do? Jesus didn't want to bring judgment. Jesus wanted to bring mercy. He wanted to help people who were on the lower tier of socioeconomic conditions, not to bring them up in society, but to show them that God loves them just as much as He loves anybody else. Yet the Pharisees viewed themselves as the ones most loved by God. I think this is a scary thing, because oftentimes in our very comfortable middle class existence, where we have pretty nice houses and steady jobs and good reputations, we look at somebody and we kind of view them out of the corner of our eyes the same way the Pharisees did. And so we look at this guy who has gotten himself in a mess with drugs, or we look at this girl who is pierced and tattooed all over the place, and we say, well, there is no hope for somebody like that. Are we not doing exactly the same thing the Pharisees did? That we're writing off a segment of the population that we're judging, and we're saying they are not going to listen to God. They have no interest in godly things. To the point that we almost feel justified in excluding the good news of the kingdom. Now, I don't think any of us would admit that, right? None of us are going to come out and say, well, you're exactly right. That's exactly how I feel about those people. But we got to look at our actions. To whom are we taking the gospel? Who is it we're looking toward to try to find a way of helping? Well, we've got to examine our attitudes, because the vast majority of the work that Jesus did was with the ignored of society. If we kind of brought it up to a modern equivalent, Jesus isn't a pulpit preacher, right? He doesn't put on his suit on Sunday and then on Monday he's done till the next Sunday. No, he's working. He's working with the outcast. He's working with those who really have been ignored. And so the lesson for us is, we don't write off that part of the population. And so tying in with kind of our major point of the day, we imitate Him. As He was the Good Samaritan, we try to be good Samaritans. We're looking for those who are in need, and we're providing that help that God can give. So let me say it one more time. study of the Pharisees can be really scary because it can hit really close to home. But what we must do if we see that application in our lives, not to be like the Pharisees and make excuses and ignore it, but rather to make the changes that we need to become like Jesus. All right, thank you very much for your good attention this morning.